servant, and the exploiter is considered to be smart, rich, and benevolent. This is a snapshot of Haiti, but there is so much more to this picture. Christopher Columbus discovered Hispaniola, currently known as Haiti, in 1492. Within 25 years upon his arrival on the island, the indigenous population of the island had just about been totally wiped out by the Spaniards. Then they started importing Africans, who they enslaved to build the territory. 15,000 Africans were taken there in 1517. The French took over the island in 1625, and its colonial period lasted until 1804. The area became known as Saint Domingue, and it is believed that up to 700,000 Africans were slaved there and worked under extremely harsh conditions to create a lot of wealth for their French colonizers. There were about 8,000 plantations, which were all worked by slaves. The climate and the soil were perfect for various crops. Right before the Haitian Revolution of 1804, Saint Domingue was the most lucrative colony on earth, producing sugar, coffee, indigo, cocoa, and cotton. One in eight people in France derived their living from Saint Domingue and the trade of its products. The colony was very lucrative for the French and devastating for the African slaves who worked for free and were terrorized. Recent scenes that we have been exposed to by the terrorist group Daesh reflect similar types of violence that African slaves were exposed to in Saint Domingue. People were tortured in front of others, quartered, burnt at the stake, raped, and even crucified to make a point that nothing but absolute obedience would be accepted from the slave towards his master. Slaves were literally worked to death. Small pockets of resistance to slavery grew, and former slaves who had escaped from plantations formed groups and carried out offensives and wars against the slave owners and their plantations. They were so fearless fighters, as their conditions as slaves were so dire, that most of them preferred to die rather than continue living under those conditions. The offensives and revolts continued in Haiti. Napoleon Bonaparte sent up to 20,000 troops from the French Empire to fight against the uprising in Haiti. But ultimately, in 1804, the former slaves ended with a victory, which led to the Haitian Revolution. The French, instead of compensating Haiti for its exploitation of the country's human and natural resources, in typical colonial fashion, demanded reparations from what is now Haiti. The country had to pay France 150 million francs, or the equivalent of $21 billion today. From 1825 to 1947, the Haitians paid off their debt to France. Instead of the newly independent country being able to spend on its people and improve their lifestyles, it had to give the majority of its money to France. It was quite difficult for the country to pay that debt. The United States then approached Haiti to offer the country help in repaying its debt, by offering loans in order for the Haitians to pay the French. U.S. banks were encouraged by the government to lend money, so Washington could have more leverage over the country. The government served as a type of guarantor to the banks and pressured Haiti to give Washington control over its trade policies and give concessions to American companies. It was difficult for Haiti to repay its loans to Washington, as up to 80% of its revenue was being paid for foreign debt. In 1914, the U.S. Navy, on behalf of the National City Bank, currently known as Citibank, sent troops to Haiti.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
This year, the United Nations celebrated the enormous contributions the African diaspora has made in every field of human endeavor by marking the first ever International Day for People of African Descent. The executive director of the United Nations Population Fund elaborates here on this day.
This International Day is an opportunity to recognize and honor the extraordinary contributions of people of African descent around the globe, to appreciate our rich heritage and culture.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to yet another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events taking place across Africa. Well, today we are reaching out to Africa's diaspora following the inaugural observance of the International Day for People of African Descent. In the second segment of our program, we shall focus on how Tunisians have come out to strongly reject the United States meddling in their country's internal affairs. So stay tuned till the end of the show.
Celebrating people of African descent. After a December 2020 resolution led by Costa Rica, this year marks the inaugural observance of the International Day for People of African Descent to promote greater recognition and respect for the diverse heritage, cultures, and contributions of people of African descent to the development of societies. The International Day for People of African Descent was celebrated for the first time on the 31st of August 2021. More than 200 million people in the Americas alone identify as being of African descent. Millions more are located worldwide outside the African continent. Whether as descendants of the victims of the transatlantic slave trade or as more recent migrants, they are amongst some of the poorest and most marginalized groups.
Now, as the world marked the first International Day for People of African Descent, UN Secretary General issued a statement through his spokesman. Let's take a listen.
First International Day of People of African Descent. In his message, the Secretary General said that this day is a celebration of the enormous contributions of people of African descent to every field of human endeavor. He added it is also long overdue recognition of the profound injustices, systematic discrimination that people of African descent have endured for centuries and continue to confront today.
Now, for more on this subject, we contacted Dr. Masharia Munene, a United Nations expert on decolonization and professor of history and international relations at the United States International University in Nairobi. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
My pleasure.
Now, our first question, what's your take on the decision by the United Nations to dedicate an International Day for people of African descent?
I think it is an important gesture by the United Nations to recognize the plight of people of African descent in various parts of the world, but mainly in the Western Hemisphere, because that's what it appears to be. It's mostly a Western Hemisphere project, not so much Europe, but it's a very good recognition gesture that there are people who are under miserable conditions, not because of their choice, but because they found themselves structurally put there over centuries, and they not as much attention to them. They tend to be minorities where they live, and as minorities, they are overlooked when looking at the entire structure of various countries.
Thank you for that, Professor Munene.
The International Day for People of African Descent comes more than a century after the Universal People of African Improvement Association held African communities its first international convention, which closed on the 31st of August 1920 in New York's Harlem neighborhood. The month-long gathering on human rights was led by the association's founder, Marcus Garvey. Apart from recognition and respect for the diverse heritage, cultures, and contributions of people of African descent, the International Day for People of African Descent also intends to highlight other issues.
It is also a day to unequivocally commit to ending all forms of racism and discrimination. People of African descent, particularly women and girls, confront inequalities, confront violence and discrimination every day. Inequalities that have been exacerbated by the current COVID pandemic. We must work together to tear down the barriers that deny people of African descent full economic, social, cultural, civil, and political rights.
Now, Professor, what are some of the major challenges facing people of African descent worldwide?
Yes. One, they generally tend to be minorities and the underclass in the various countries. And as underclass people who, because of racism, inherent racism, and the circumstances under which they found themselves in those countries, dealing with them or trying to uplift them becomes a very major challenge. In part because the governments and the states in those places are part of the problems, because they are the ones who condone and encourage racism, structural racism, and mistreatment of people simply because they look different or they are not European. That's the main thing. They are not of European background and therefore to be mistreated that way.
Well, people of African descent in the United States continue to endure systematic racism in a country whose rulers claim to respect human rights. The brutal murder of George Floyd is a typical example of what African Americans undergo every day. George Floyd's brother urged the United Nations Human Rights Council to investigate police killings of black people in America and help him get justice for his brother's death.
When people raise their voices to protest the treatment of black people in America, they are silenced. They are shot and killed. My brother, George Floyd, is one of the many black men and women that have been murdered by police in recent years. The sad truth is that the case is not unique. The way you saw my brother tortured and murdered on camera is the way black people are treated by police in America. You watched my brother die. That could have been me. I am my brother's keeper. You and the United Nations are your brothers and sisters' keepers in America, and you have the power to help us get justice for my brother George Floyd. I am asking you to help him. I am asking you to help me. I am asking you to help us, black people in America.
Well, the suffering of people of African descent has especially come into focus in the United States, which claims to champion democracy and human rights. Now, Professor, why are African Americans being subjected to institutional racism?
The United States is a contradiction in itself. It espouses great ideas about democracy, human rights, and the will of the rights of people. But in practice, it does the opposite, especially when it comes to the African Americans. So the racism in the United States is structural, it is historical, it's long-lasting. What had happened in recent times, that racism appeared to have been camouflaged until last year or so, when there was the George Floyd issue of the police, and it was not the only one, where the police deliberately kill somebody just because he's black. and it captured the world imagination. But it is not a new thing. That's the problem. It is long lasting. It is ingrained in the blood system, the veins of the American body politic, and therefore it occasionally flares up.
The United Nations Human Rights Council recently urged global action, including reparations, to make amends for racism against people of African descent. The UN's Human Rights Chief, Michelle Bachelet, has been leading calls for reparations.
In light of these profound and wide-ranging injustices, there is an urgent need to confront the legacies of enslavement, the transatlantic slave trade, colonialism and successive racially discriminatory policies and systems, and to seek reparatory justice. Despite some initiatives towards truth-seeking and limited forms of reparation, including memorialization, acknowledgments, apologies, and litigation, our research could not find a single example of a state that has comprehensively reckoned with the past or accounted for its impact on the lives of people of African descent today.
How can the wrongs of slavery be redressed, and is it about time now to seriously address the issue of reparations for evils during slave trade and colonialism?
Yes, it is time to consider reparations and rectification of the harm of slavery and colonialism. The problem is that those who are supposed to do the reparation and the rectifications may not be willing, because they first of all have to admit the error, the crimes they committed. And if they do not admit, and this is not just individuals here and there, but the whole governing structure of the West has to acknowledge the crime, the crime of slavery, the crime of colonialism, and the crime of invasions. Now, if the organizers of countries, the people who run the country, the responsible people, do not admit that there were crimes, then there will be no reparations.
2019 marked 400 years since enslaved people arrived in America. Now, some African Americans are returning back to their roots in Africa. Here, one of the returnees who has applied for Rwandese citizenship speaks out.
For me, and many of us, as you've seen from our group, what we want is to be able to live in peace, to be able to do business. We have a lot of talent that we want to share. We're not coming to take over. We're coming to be a part of what's going on.
Now, Professor, there is a movement to return to Africa by some people of African descent from across the world. What is the significance of this move to return to their roots?
Well, it's a sentimental move. It's emotional. It's a question of identification. And it's practical for a few people. And it's not new, because from the 1880s and 1890s, there was that effort for the particular black elite in the Americas to say their home is Africa, therefore they should go back to Africa and be able to blend in, which is a good thing. It's seen in the same way with the Gavi movement in the 1910s and 20s. Go to Africa because that's where your home is. Go and fit in. So Back to Africa movement is something that keeps on coming up when times are bad and people feel desperate in the West, particularly in the Americas.
Thank you very much, Dr. Macharia Munene, a United Nations expert on decolonization, on the very emotional subject of the African diaspora. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on the recent move by Tunisians to reject United States meddling in their country. So don't go away.
Tunisians reject meddling.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Tunisia's influential General Labour Union, UGTT, and two political parties recently turned down an offer to discuss the country's political crisis with a visiting U.S. congressional delegation, insisting they reject any foreign meddling in the country's crisis.
The UGTT union spokesman, Sami Tahri, says they did not accept the bullying of foreigners in the time of former Western-backed President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali and will not accept it today and tomorrow. The remarks came amid reports that a delegation led by U.S. Senator Chris Murphy was in Tunisia to discuss what they termed as protecting democracy in Tunisia. The visit came after President Kais Saied constitutionally took over powers of the Prime Minister and dissolved Parliament in July in an extraordinary measure to save the country.
Local critics dismissed the move as a coup. However, many Tunisians have fully supported the decision by President Kais Saied. Well, for more on the anti-US sentiments in Tunisia, we have contacted Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Tunisians resoundingly rejected US interference in their country's internal affairs during the visit by two senators. Why is the US unpopular in this North African country?
Tunisia was the first to initiate the Arab Spring and is not going to accept an outside intervention in the country. They want to solve their own problems on their own, and President Kais Saied seems so far to handling the situation in harmony with the population. Otherwise, he can't stay for very long, and people will turn against him. On the contrary, we see he still benefit from 70% to 80% of the support of the population when he said, I'm going to fight corruption. And we have seen the U.S. Allies in many parts of the Middle East and West Asia who are corrupted, and this is what the Americans like. This is not going to happen in Tunisia as long as President Kais Saied is in power.
Thank you for that.
In typical American coercive and condescending attitude towards other countries, Democrat Senator Chris Murphy has threatened to push for the cutting of Washington's aid to Tunisia over President Saied's failure to form a new government. What interests is the United States pursuing by interfering in Tunisia's internal affairs?
The U.S. is an empire and is trying to protect his influence all over the world. In West Asia, the U.S. is losing power. We saw how the U.S. forces were forced to withdraw from Afghanistan. They are forced to withdraw from Iraq. So in Tunisia, they're trying to keep some interference, waiving the humanitarian support that Tunisia needs, and trying to keep some sort of influence over the country, because this is the nature of the U.S. They can't stop doing that by trying to impose their will over every country they can. But in the case of Tunisia, the population will not allow this to happen.
Tunisian President Kais Saied has reiterated that his country would not tolerate any foreign interference as he faces rising pressure from Western governments on the country's political situation.
President Saeed issued this statement following meetings with high-ranking U.S. and European Union officials, including EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell. Now, are Western countries favoring a particular faction in the current political crisis in Tunisia?
The European and the Americans have established good relationship with the speaker that was removed by President Kais Saied when he suspended the parliament and removed the prime minister according to the constitution, Article 80. And Tunisia is in the center of this part of Northern Africa, where countries around Tunisia can be affected by foreign intervention, by Europe, by the US, by any other intervention. This is why it is very important what is happening to Tunisia, particularly because the population is very much alive and can react and can and holds the final decision. This is why the Europeans and the Americans are trying to be as close as possible to the event in Tunisia to grab the opportunity and try to impose the people they want or force something on President Kais Saied.
Now, on July the 25th, President Saied, who was elected in 2019, froze parliament, dismissed the prime minister, and assumed executive authority.
The first decision is to freeze all the powers of parliament. The second decision is to lift the immunity of all members of parliament. The third decision is that the president assumes the executive authority with the help of a prime minister appointed by the president of the republic.
Nearly 2 months after Saeed's move, he has still not appointed a new government, but has indicated he was preparing to change the country's constitution using existing constitutional means. However, Tunisia's parliament speaker and head of the Ennahda party insists the move is unconstitutional.
These decisions have no basis in the constitution nor in the law. This is a coup against the constitution, against the 2011 revolution, and against liberties.
President Saeed extended the suspension of parliament until further notice and says his intervention was needed to save the country from collapse. What really necessitated these dramatic measures?
It is the lack of reform and job opportunities for the people of Tunisia. This is an opportunity that was given to the Tunisian prime minister, who failed to achieve this objective, and the parliament did not do anything to question the government. So by allowing the situation to deteriorate, the situation in the country became unbearable to the population, and the president was in a position, because the constitution allows him to do so, to suspend everything and try to find a way to stop the corruption and reform the country. And now he's calling for a general referendum because he wants to see if the population is supporting the step that he's doing or not.
Saudi Arabia and Bahrain are arguably the least democratic Arab countries, yet they are wholeheartedly backed by the United States. It's quite clear that Washington pursues other imperialistic objectives and not democratic values, as it claims.
The United States claims to support democracy in Tunisia, while at the same time it tolerates dictatorial and repressive regimes in the region and other parts of the world. Now, what's the reason for such double standards?
It is the nature of the Americans to do so. When they call upon democracy, and we see the President Donald Trump, for example, who hailed 15 times dictators in West Asia and in the Middle East. So calling upon democracy is exactly what the Americans love to use when they want to interfere in a country. In Saudi Arabia, it being a monarchy, a country that is named by a family that rules the country, and the Americans are very happy with that, as long as the Saudis are paying them enough money to keep them happy and to buy all the weapons they need.
a very interesting perspective on how the United States pursues double standards in its foreign policy across the world. Thanks a lot, Mr. Magnier, for your time. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Until our next episode, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Arbain Walking History. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said, "Arbain has arrived again as the greatest ever gathering in the history of mankind." Millions of people from many countries start walking the 80-kilometer distance from Najaf to Karbala to mark the most prominent symbol of humanity and freedom, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The glory of the event is not describable at all, as no camera is capable of capturing its grandeur, and no tongue is able to talk on it. Hundreds of thousands of pilgrims, mostly Iraqis, start their walking from hundreds of kilometers away from Karbala. Houses, shops, Husseiniyas, mosques, and tourist buildings have all been dedicated to the zealous pilgrims and lovers of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, is one of the masters of the youth of paradise, as Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said on many occasions. The Holy Prophet also said, "Indeed, there is a warmth for Hussein in the hearts of the faithful which will never cool down." In recent years, over 20 million people have converged in the largest ever gathering of human beings in history in Iraq, all of whom walk towards a magnet with the universal motto of "The love of Hussein has gathered us here." Arbain marks the 40th day after the martyrdom of the Prophet's younger grandson, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The walking pilgrims follow in the footsteps of Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, who marched towards the tomb of his brother to relate him the hardships and calamities that had befallen on her after her brother's martyrdom. Pilgrimage on foot is the preferred way of pilgrimage throughout history. For instance, Prophet Adam, peace be upon him, 70 times before the pilgrimage of the symbolic House of God in Mecca on foot. Many religious leaders have done this in different eras. The Holy Prophet's elder grandson, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace be upon him, used to perform the Hajj pilgrimage barefoot. The Caesar of Rome had vowed to walk to Beit al-Maqaddas if he triumphed over Iranians. So, after defeating Iranians, he walked from his palace in Constantinople to Beit al-Maqaddas in Palestine. The walk of Arba'in was very difficult and could even be fatal during the rule of the former Iraqi dictator Saddam. But after the ouster of the dictator, millions of Iraqis and non-Iraqis have rushed every year for this unique event. According to statistics, in 2003, some 3 million people took part in the Arba'in walk. But the numbers increased every year. In 2012, more than 10 million people had participated in the event, and the number reached 15 million next year, in 2013. The number increased to nearly 20 million in recent years, despite the threats of the savage ISIL terrorists. What is spectacular and noteworthy in this huge gathering is the participation of Muslims from all denominations, both Sunnis and Shias, and the faithful from other religions such as Christians, Zoroastrians, Sabians, and Yazidis. The day of Ashura has transcended history and geography. It keeps impacting pure consciences and the hearts of the faithful. The Arba'in walk has had no precedent in the history of mankind. This has an outward appearance, but the inward is far deeper and glorious and effective as it builds the spirit and makes the individual more prepared for marching in the hardships of life against tyranny and corruption. The body of the pilgrim is exhausted in the long walk, but the spirit becomes stronger and stronger. Those who participate in the walk of Arba'in practice altruism and sympathy for all mankind. They come out of the boundaries of their mean desires and personal interests. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressing a number of Iraqi hosts of pilgrims in 2019, said, "The Arba'in walk is really quite a unique event. We have not seen either in our own era or throughout history such a gathering and such a move that occurs and keeps growing year after year. This is unique. This movement of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, plays a role in the cognizance of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Arba'in, with this move that mainly is performed between Najaf and Karbala in the walk every year, has been universalized. The eyes of the peoples of the world have been drawn to this movement. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and the cognizance of him have been universalized thanks to this great popular movement. This is the blood of Hussein, son of Ali ibn Abi Talib, which is gushing forth and refreshing us every day. And this is the message of Ashura, which is emitted from the throats of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein and Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon them, in absolute loneliness and has been engulfing the world. The Arba'in walk is undoubtedly the greatest gathering in the entire human history, no matter how much the Western media try to ignore it. For sure, in the near future, this monopoly of the American Zionist-controlled media will end, and the peoples of the world will see the unmatched love and passion for Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the Lord of freedom seekers and those who love justice."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
After liberating the whole province of Al Bayda from the Saudi-backed groups, Yemen's armed forces began moving toward the eastern region of Shabwa. Bayhan, Ain and Usaylan directorates were captured during the first phase of the operation.
The Yemeni army is making these advances in Shabwa with the support of God, because there is a big difference in what we and the enemy possess in military capabilities. We are fully aware that the enemy does not want peace. They are the ones who launched the aggression against the Yemeni people, and they seek to keep our country weak. Therefore, we will continue to resist until we force the enemy to submit to the will of the Yemeni people and stop its year-long war and siege.
Military experts say the liberated areas have strategic importance as they are overlooking Ataq, the capital of Shabwa governorate, as well as Harib area of Marib, meaning that all supply routes linking Shabwa with Marib will be cut off for the Saudi-backed forces.
These advances come as part of the process of encircling Marib because the Saudi-led coalition did not respond to our peace initiative regarding Marib, and therefore a military operation is necessary to cut the supply routes linking Shabwa with Marib, especially the areas of Baylan, Ain, or Ceylon, which the Saudi-backed forces depended on. During the next 24 hours, we may witness more significant developments, especially in the Harib and Arabiana districts in Marib.
Recently, the Yemeni army has captured vast areas in the oil-rich province of Marib from the Saudi-backed forces. This has pushed Yemen's army to upscale its operations and move toward eastern areas to liberate all Yemen's soil from foreign powers.
Yemenis say the army is determined to liberate Yemen's territories from the hands of invaders. They believe that the army has the upper hand and will eventually expel all proxies of the U.S., Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates from the country. Yav Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Far away from their homes, the battle for survival continues for thousands of Rohingya refugees living across India. After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of the world. But in India, they are sometimes called illegal immigrants and threat to national security, which activists describe as a deliberate attempt to target a particular community. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities, but these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis. Based on analysis of the Government Crime Records Agency for 2020, Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Analysts say there is no case of terror, rape, or keeping arms against any Rohingya refugee, which belies the government claim of calling them a security threat.
We just want to stay alive. We are no threat to anyone since we are humans and have family too. We are really in a miserable state as a detention and expulsion campaign is going on.
Based on official estimates, some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India. Many refugees I spoke with had almost similar views. They say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against the community are haunting them. As refugee crises continue to be the biggest challenge facing the world, rights activists say Rohingya community in particular has largely been ignored despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy regardless of the geostrategic interest, and stand by its ethos, considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
In the downtown area of Kashmir's capital city, Srinagar,
exemplifies the centuries of traditions and legacy that came to Kashmir via Silk Road from Central Asia. This part of the main city, Srinagar, remains untouched by modernization. Set up on the banks of River Jhelum, the downtown Srinagar is home to many scholars who came to Kashmir along with their disciples to preach Islam. Some 7 centuries ago, Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani came from Iran along with scores of artisans, preachers, scent makers and traditional healers. These men settled around the banks of River Jhelum and taught their specialities to the locals. And to date, these teachings are the source of survival for tens of thousands of people in Srinagar. Let's meet probably the last scent maker of Kashmir, Azizullah Kosgar. Few steps away from the shrine of Shah-e Hamdan or Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani, this is an Arke Gulab Dukan or Rosewater Shop. It is a major attraction for tourists and the younger generation. The 65-year-old Kosgar's shop is filled with centuries-old jars, some empty and a few partly filled. Kosgar is the last remaining rosewater maker. This shop carries 400 years of Kashmir's legacy.
For Muslims, rose water has a spiritual as well as religious significance. This shop was set in 1820, and these glass bottle jars and decanters were imported from different parts of the world. We have a collection of other fragrances besides rose water. We have been making herbal medicines, but now people prefer modern science instead of traditional methods.
The Kosgar family has been in the trade for distilling rose water for 4 centuries, and the entire process is done manually. His customers, however, can't do without his handmade fragrances and herbal syrups.
We have been living here for centuries, and we know the worth of his pure rose water and other products. Besides that, his herbal syrups and ointments have been healing our ailments, whether related to skin or immunity. We use his rose water during special occasions and during the holy month of Ramadan to make special drinks.
Kosgar's rose water is made specifically from Kashmiri roses and has been used for centuries to perfume shrines and mosques, since it is believed to be extracted in the best of its form. Azizullah Kosgar has acquired these skills from his forefathers who had traveled here from Turkey some 500 years ago. He says they have kept the secret method rolling from one generation to another, but he fears whether his son will take it or not and wishes that somebody comes forward and takes the legacy ahead. Kosgar says the political uncertainty, lockdowns and lack of people's interest in pure rose water have resulted in falling demand, and these reasons might sooner or later force the closure of his centuries-old business in Srinagar. Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
It was the usual glad handing and bon ami for the cameras, but after a 90-minute discussion and photo op, there would have been very little of substance for Boris Johnson to claim as marquee victories for his administration. It was the reluctance of President Joe Biden to guarantee the coveted free trade agreement worth nearly £300 billion a year with London that would have been the most bitter pill to swallow. Britain's exit from the EU and the fallout from the shaky Northern Ireland Protocol has been cited as a major sticking point, though President Biden attempted to downplay the link.
There are two separate issues. On the deal with the UK, that's continued to be discussed. But on the protocols, I feel very strongly about those.
Johnson tried to shrug off suggestions the prospect of a deal were disappearing.
The Biden administration is not doing free trade deals around the world right now, but I've got absolutely every confidence that a great deal is there to be done.
Analysts across the Atlantic are certain both issues are intrinsically linked, but crucially it also undermines Johnson's Brexit credentials.
A trade deal with the United States is very important for Boris Johnson. That's what he was more or less promising when Britain left the European Union. That's what he was dangling in front of us, that everything was going to be okay. Britain would be an international player signing these trade deals of this and that. The one with America was the most important, and he's not got it. And it puts the relationship between Britain and the United States, the so-called special relationship, in perspective.
It would have been a political triumph for Prime Minister Boris Johnson, returning from a successful visit to the White House and brandishing on the floor of the House the details of a free trade agreement with Washington worth hundreds of billions of pounds. Now Johnson finds himself playing the waiting game and hoping against hope that his EU strategy pays off. Boris Johnson will head back to face his ministers to perhaps sell the idea of the UK joining the existing trade deal that's already up and running between the US, Canada and Mexico. But for many inside government and indeed the wider Conservative Party, it may well feel like a backward step. Amina Taylor, London.
As government ministers from the 27-nation EU arrived for a meeting at the European Council building in Brussels on Tuesday, it became apparent very quickly that the bloc is lurching towards a bitter showdown with some of its closest allies.
We see when we look at the Brexit agreements that they are not well implemented, that they are not fully respected. We see it with AUKUS that there was some hidden things, so it's not the best context to have trust between us.
Senior European Commission officials told the EU affairs ministers that Brexit issues relating to Northern Ireland must be sorted out before January 1st. The Commission accuses Britain of breaking its end of the deal.
We need to rebuild the trust. We are ready to do that. We are working very intensely within the Commission. We want to arrive together with our UK partners in the joint solutions.
Outside the meeting, members of workers' unions gathered to warn of further problems for the EU unless poverty and exclusion are addressed.
People are starting to lose hope a bit in the EU project, and I think the Brexit was clearly a sign of that. And I think the recipe to change this is to have a more social Europe.
EU affairs ministers agreed to seek further information on the move by the US, Britain and Australia to scupper a multi-billion euro submarine deal that Paris had with Canberra.
We definitely remain committed to cooperation with our partners on the international stage, but any new alliances that may appear, of course, raise a number of questions.
The controversy surrounding the new US, UK and Australia weapons agreement, known as AUKUS, has been raised with Maurice Payne, the Australian Foreign Minister.
I inquired about the reasons behind the lack of prior consultation on AUKUS and regretted that this alliance excluded European partners.
Officials tell me Borrell did not get a straight answer as to why France and the EU were blindsided. It's clear, however, Canberra was lobbied by Washington and London. At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Yemenis from all walks of life took to the streets of the capital Sana'a to commemorate the revolution that took place on September 21, 2014. Following that revolution, the government of the former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi collapsed.
The 21st September revolution means freedom and independence for us, which prompted 17 countries led by Saudi Arabia to launch a war on Yemen on 26 March 2015. This revolution is a resistance against the Israeli project in the region and a resistance against Saudi Arabia's miscalculations, which is prevalent in our country. So today we are paying the price for our freedom.
Our protest is in response to the call of the leader of the Ansarullah movement, and it is a commemoration of the anniversary of the 21st September revolution, during which Yemenis gained freedom, independence and sovereignty of their country.
Protesters said the revolution was triggered by the Yemenis themselves without any foreign intervention as a result of the deterioration of living conditions under the rule of the former president.
This large demonstration is evidence of the growing awareness among the Yemenis of the need to get out of the state of exclusion that prevailed under the rule of the former regime. The 21st September revolution saved Yemenis from external domination, and Yemenis today own their decision. The battles that are taking place today between Yemeni army and the Saudi-backed forces are the result of the Yemenis' exit from Saudi control.
We came out today to announce to the world that the September 21st revolution is the revolution of all free Yemenis, and to affirm our rejection of foreign domination and our boycott of proxies and traitors, whether in Yemen or the rest of the Arab countries.
Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi was backed by Saudi Arabia, that even waged an ongoing war to reinstate him. The Saudi-led war on the country has killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions of others since 2015.
Yemenis say their revolution was aimed at preserving the sovereignty of their country, which was under the control of the US and Saudi proxies. They believe that the Saudi brutal war on their country is the price for the freedom they have gained. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
As the 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York, world leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern. This year, like the past few years, the fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and anti-Tehran sanctions were among the issues mentioned in the speeches. In his first address to the Assembly as the U.S. President, Joe Biden reiterated his administration's position on the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
The United States remains committed to preventing Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon. We are working with the P5 plus one to engage Iran diplomatically and to seek a return to JCPOA. We're prepared to return to full compliance if Iran does the same.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, who was also speaking for the first time to the UN General Assembly, said Tehran has no trust in U.S. promises and noted that his country will welcome talks that would lead to the complete removal of sanctions against Tehran.
The Islamic Republic considers as useful talks whose ultimate outcome is the lifting of all oppressive sanctions. While decisively defending all its rights and the interests of its people, Iran is keen to have large-scale political and economic cooperation and convergence with the rest of the world.
He slammed the restrictions, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic, as tantamount to crimes against humanity. Elsewhere in his remarks, President Raisi said the time for exercising hegemony and violating the will of nations have long passed.
This year, two scenes made history. One was on January the 6th, when the U.S. Congress was attacked by the people. And two, when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August. From the capital to Kabul, one clear message was sent to the world. The United States' hegemonic system has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. What is seen in our region today proves that not only the hegemon and the idea of hegemony, but also the project of imposing westernized identity have failed miserably.
The Iranian president said, pursuing hegemony results in bloodshed, instability, and ultimately defeat and retreat. He noted that the U.S. isn't withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan, but is being ousted. President Raisi's remarks appeared to be setting the tone for the upcoming Vienna talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA, which are due to resume over the next few weeks. Iran says it doesn't want anything beyond its rights, that is, the implementation of international law.
The Taliban has unveiled the name of 17 individuals as the newly appointed high-ranking officials for some ministries and other key governmental bodies, such as the country's Directorate of Atomic Energy. The Taliban claim they have done their best to include a number of well-educated people to the new list of the group's acting cabinet ministers.
The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan keeps trying to appoint more professional and well-educated people as top government officials in order to offer better service to our nation and strengthen Islamic governance system here.
The Taliban's move to appoint 17 new top government officials comes as the group's leadership had already pledged to establish an inclusive government. However, many here in Afghanistan believe the symbolic presence of some officials on behalf of some ethnic groups does not mean that the Taliban is trying to form an inclusive government.
We are waiting for establishment of a real inclusive government